Publishing Talks, a podcast about the book industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm interviewing Cassia Crozier, who runs a blog website called BookSquare. How are you, Cassia?
I'm very good. Thank you, David.
So you recently went to Frankfurt, and am I correct in understanding it was the first time that you went?
Yeah, because it's not necessarily my business, so I'm not buying or selling rights, so I have no reason to go there, and was lucky enough to be invited to speak at the O'Reilly Tools of Change conference there.
And how was it, I mean, as a first-time visitor to, I mean, I should say it's the Frankfurt Book Fair held annually, and it's been held for many, many years in Frankfurt, Germany. Originally, I think it was meant to be an international rights fair. It's grown to be that plus a kind of gathering of the tribes, if you will, for the book industry internationally. But for someone who has not been before, what was it like?
Well, it's just BEA on steroids would be the first description. It's unbelievably huge. I think people in the United States tend to view the book industry as an American concept. And just walking through the various halls, and I advise sensible shoes for that, something I did not, the advice I did not take for myself. It's a massive thing. The industry, it's worldwide, and I can't even describe how many books and how many people you see and realize the book business is really, really big.
Well, there are a lot of countries, and each country, I mean, that is a sort of amazing thing. Each country has a publishing business in it. You know, sometimes you get inquiries as a publisher from strange countries that you didn't realize actually published books in their own languages, but of course, almost everyone does.
Yeah.
And of course, they're interested. I mean, you know, the English language book industry is probably the largest, I think it is, in the world, although, you know, there may be more Chinese readers than there are English-speaking readers. But aside from the sense of, you know, the kind of tension between the different countries thinking, there does seem to be a different view of how the book business and how the book itself is evolving in different countries. Did you get a chance to talk to people about that?
Yeah, I actually highlighted a couple things just because they kind of changed my thinking. I've been huge on accessibility and ebooks for many years, and I'm really pleased that that aspect of the book experience is coming to light. But one gentleman, his name is Arthur Atwell, kind of changed my thinking about accessibility in that he's working on a program in South Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, actually trying to get books into regions where there is no book-selling infrastructure. You know, we for me to buy a book is I open my Kindle or my laptop and I buy a book. I possess that book within moments. Considering people who have no bookstore. They have no book buying culture at all, and so he's working with a culture about, he's actually creating a system where he can use the existing infrastructure, telephone lines, DSL connections, whatever, cable, to electronically deliver a book to a local copy shop, because every town in the world pretty much has a copy shop, a kind of a central repository for sending and receiving that kind of information. The book gets delivered to that venue, and then the customer on the other end goes through the commercial transaction. You know, each person along the line takes a small piece of the book purchase, but you've got a legal purchase happening of a book in a place where there was no commerce established. And I'm just thinking, okay, that's accessibility to me. That's actually bringing books and readers together in a way that they couldn't access them before.
Well, that's a really interesting application of a technology that in America, you know, we we sort of have, but have not really fully activated. And years ago, there was a company called Sprout, which created a model that was identical to what you just described. Books, electronic books on a server, delivered on demand to a local print, a book-making machine, much like the Espresso, mm-hmm. although theirs was using high-speed HP printers, and then you had a trimmer and an inline binder. It's all kind of a rudimentary book-making shop. And their idea was, and I think Borders actually invested in it, the idea was that you could put one of these in a store, and then if somebody came in and wanted a book that wasn't in the store, you'd print it for them. And that idea never took off, probably because here in the United States we have such good access. So what you're saying, is kind of interesting, that idea actually has a better application in places where there is not a book-selling infrastructure or a delivery system where people can go and buy a book when they want it.
Exactly. And it's just to me, I'm just thinking, wow, we have never, I don't think about that as a person who has books on demand, literally. I've had books on demand my whole life. My mother was my elementary school librarian. There's never been a time where I couldn't get whatever I wanted book-wise.
No, that's true. Well, we live in a world of vast richness,
yes.
of all so many different ways in the United States, and also in, I think, Western Europe, the access to culture is phenomenally different than it is in so many other parts of the world. And that sort of leads into another question. There was, and I actually didn't follow this very closely, but there was a talk, and it may have, I don't know whether it was at the O'Reilly or at the Frankfurt Convention itself, but there was a discussion about culture and accessibility, scholarship, all having to do with electronic books. Were you at that event?
No, I was not at the event, and I'm only familiar with it from Richard Nash's write-up and a few other write-ups, but it was, how do I put this delicately? It sounded to me like it was a scholar who doesn't live in the real world poo-pooing the idea that people really needed to have access to all of this scholarship that he has access to.
Right.
It's a twist on the elitism, because he was trying to make the anti-elitist argument and ended up betraying his extreme bias toward keeping the information from people.
Although it did kind of expose this sort of the thing that you were starting to talk about at the beginning, this idea that there are so many people involved in the book business and so many cultures involved that there are differing views that we often, and I say we being the people in the United States mostly, we're simply not aware of the vast differences in perspective and opinion that exist in the world about ideas and culture, history, law. I mean, you think about this in terms of European concepts of scholarship versus American, but also other cultures' understandings of what is the meaning of access. Not necessarily always do we agree with each other on what that all means.
But I think we need to listen to the, this has come to a head recently with the Google book settlement and the moral rights issues in Europe. Now, as you are well aware, we are arguing the minutiae of the settlement to the point of ridiculousness, but the moral rights argument is rarely discussed in American book circles because that's not our focus. It's a concept that doesn't really exist in our copyright law.
Can you explain it?
Very rudimentarily, and I'm clearly not a copyright scholar, but basically it has more to do with the fact that the author or the artist, let's call them artists because it extends beyond that, and actually owns the copyright, then essentially licenses it to a publisher. But the Google book settlement is largely dealing with the publisher and has sucked up some rights that the authors, especially in Europe, retained for themselves, and now these authors are being forced to deal with the settlement when they did not agree in the first place because of the parties negotiating. It was the American Association of Publishers, it was the Authors Guild in the U.S. So these two parties actually negotiated, probably not necessarily in bad faith, but in a way that left the European authors who actually own a different set of rights or possess a different set of rights out of the bargaining table. Now these authors have essentially had these rights taken away from them, and so this is their argument, saying, hey, you know, we were party to a settlement that did not take our actual rights into consideration. It took your perception of our rights into the consideration.
Right, which, although you could argue that if as long as Google is scanning books that were published in America legally, and those rights were granted by the originating authors or publishers in Europe and elsewhere, that they are dealing with the American, licensed American rights holders, that it would be, in fact, between Google and whoever it is owns the copyright right in the United States.
Yeah, but most of these contracts do not, and I'm presuming, I actually haven't read them all, do not include a digitization path.
Oh, that's fair. You're talking about books that were printed or published years before the idea of digitization ever came about.
Right. So the agreements are not largely silent on the issue. So I think it's a fair argument on both sides. And ultimately, we've talked about this before, I'm actually in favor of the Google Book Search Project very much. I am less sanguine about the way the Authors Guild and the AAP settled it. I actually think that they gave Google far more than they would have gotten had they just continued with the scanning program.
Yeah, it's interesting. It is interesting too. You know, it's for me a subject that I find it to be complex to the point of mind-breaking.
Yes.
But I think in principle, the idea of making Google's principle of making the world's knowledge available online is actually a noble and positive thing, but it is very complex once you go downstream from the principle to the reality of what that means. And there are so many different views and so many different people to be accommodated whose interests are varied and not necessarily in agreement.
I still think we could have achieved this goal in a smarter way.
It hasn't even fully played out yet. There is a upcoming court meeting in November.
Right.
But there are so many different things that can happen. Even if, you know, at this level of the court, things are resolved, then you could, you can appeal it to a higher court. I mean, this could go on and on and on, and probably will. And,
yes.
You know, we'll have, you know, we can talk about, probably have this as a conversation for a really long time. But before, since I'm going to try to keep these interviews not too long, so people actually feel like they can listen to them, I did want to ask you a little bit about a couple of things you wrote about this week that I thought were really interesting. One is you said Stephen King repeats the stupid meme, and I would love for you to talk just a little bit about what that relates to. The Stephen King's next novel being released in digital form at a really high price.
Well, there are a couple funny aspects of this. One, of course, is that his new book, Under the Dome, I think it's called, is very page heavy. He's gone the Neal Stephenson route, apparently, and created just a 1,000-page book. And the hardcover price is $35, which I have no idea if that is a good price point for the Stephen King reader. It may very well be, but that's $35 is a very expensive book. of course, then this book got caught up in the price wars between Amazon, Walmart, Target, and Sears. And the hardcover edition is essentially available to many, many customers for under $10.
Wow.
Unfortunately, the digital list price of the ebook remains at a hefty $35, which I find to be absolutely egregious, but we'll set that aside for the ebook pricing conversation. Okay, but then Stephen King comes in and essentially says, and his publisher also says, that the reason they are delaying the actual release of the ebook is to, quote-unquote, protect the hardcover and or the independent bookseller. Now, this is assuming this theory only works if the ebook customer is going to shrug and say, well, I can't get an ebook, I'm just going to go buy hardcover.
Right.
That's the ebook customer is making the switch to the different format for a lot of reasons, price being one of them, but convenience, actual format preference. They're not necessarily going to say, hey, you're holding it back, I'm going to wait patiently. They're going to forget about it. Because what's the next book down the line? How many books are released, 300,000, 400,000 in the U.S. alone every year?
Right, and how many books is it possible for one human being to read in a year?
Exactly. So the longer the larger the window between the time you have consumer awareness, because all of the marketing push goes to that hardcover release. There may be some when they go mass market, but consumer awareness, lack of availability. This happened with the Hilary Mantel book. It won the Booker, and everybody on Twitter is very, very excited about this, you know, book. They can't wait to read it. They go looking for it and discover they cannot buy it in the U.S. You have absolute awareness of a book. It's in the mind of consumers. They're actually going out and trying to make a purchase and discovering they can't do it. Now you have to hope that they're going to remember to buy this book 2-3 weeks later, 3 months later, a year later, whatever the release cycle is.
Right. No, I think that most book publishers have recognized that. And, of course, retailers realize it, too, that and we have this terrible conundrum that there's no connection between publicity and availability.
Right.
But what I think you're arguing is, and I think this point is very valid, that the ebook reader is a separate and distinct reader from the hardback reader, and that it's not that if you hold back the hardcover, it isn't going to work, that the majority of those people who would have bought the ebook will in fact buy a hardcover instead.
Right. There's no evidence of that at all, and you know we're seeing a shift in how consumers behave. They're actually, you know, before we were pretty comfortable, you had your hardcover, your trade, your mass market consumer, and the mass market consumer didn't really pay attention. They weren't looking at the hardcover release date and saying, okay, 12 months from now, I'm going to put this on my calendar, I will buy this book. It's a different consumer base, and it tends to be, I'm not going to say more browser-based, but they're not necessarily paying attention to what's going on in the hardcover market except to say, oh, new so-and-so book. But they're not setting a tickler, you know, for 6 months, a year down the line to buy a book. The ebook consumer is still, I think, an active first window consumer. They've just switched formats. There's a mix between reformed hardcover readers or whatever you want to call it, and new to the hardcover market, people who were formerly mass market customers, who are starting to buy in the hardcover window just because the price is comfortable for them. But they're not the same customer anymore. The hardcover customer and the ebook customer are not interchangeable.
Right. I think that's an important point. And of course this is all emerging territory, but it looks to me, and I agree with you, that it seems self-destructive to delay the ebook to protect the hardcover. It works on a, you know, kind of less than zero-sum game idea. You know, that I think there are ebook readers, more and more, there are e-book readers, and there are print book readers. And the e-book reader is not someone who's going to be enticed to buy a 1,000-page hardcover. In fact, the irony is typically someone who makes the move to digital reading does it because they don't want to lug around 1,000-page books.
Exactly.
So what you've done essentially is stabbed that person in the eye and said, don't buy my book.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and as you said, there are other books to read. I think that the reality that most marketers are aware of is that capturing the attention of a consumer is a really hard thing to do. And once you've captured them, you've got to convert them to a buyer. And
exactly.
So what you're saying, and I think I agree, is you go to all this trouble to create the event, and the person who is the ebook reader is not able to convert on
mm-hmm.
that spot when they want it. They will buy something else to read, and when the ebook finally does become available, they may have moved on. And not only that, they may have felt the sting of not being treated appropriately when the new book came out, and they may actively decline to read your book when the book is eventually released
yeah.
as an ebook. And they may also react negatively to the price model. I mean, this is the other thing that you know, obviously bears much longer discussion than we can have today, and that is a theory of pricing for ebooks, which has to take into account the perception of the consumer that an ebook should be less expensive than a print book because there is less cost in it.
Agree.
Whether now that and that we'll save that for another conversation.
Yeah, you know who you also want to talk to about that is Michael Tamblyn.
I will definitely put him on my list to talk
yeah.
to, because I think the theory of pricing is very important. We're not expert in it. I don't proclaim myself to be in any way an expert, but I think it's a wonderful opportunity to learn how to really achieve success in pricing.
Yes. And
so,
it can be done.
I think you're right. So, well, thanks so much, Cassia, for taking some time to talk to me today. This has been Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing business. I'm David Wilk, and thank you again.
You're welcome.